ॐ ज्ञानचिनिनं तस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलकाय चक्षुर्मिलितां येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं दधाति शपदां वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरौ श्रीयुतापदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं सागरसाथं सहगनागनतान्वितं सजीवम् साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगनाललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्ण करुणासिन्धौ दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकान्ता राधाकान्तनमोस्तुते तप्ताकांशन गौरांगी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभनुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये वाञ्छाकोपितृभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धोभ्यैव च पतितानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभुनित्यानन्द श्रीयाद्वैतगदाधर शिवाशरि गौरभक्तगण हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। So Dhru Maharaj was insulted by his stepmother, and he, under the instruction of his mother, left home to search out God. And by the grace of Narad Muni, by following Narada's instructions, he was able very quickly to realize the presence of the personality of Godhead. He was able to achieve such perfections that he became practically as heavy as the whole universe. And when he stopped up his breathing, all the demigods felt as if they were suffocating. So they approached the Lord in distress, and the Lord said, "Don't worry, it's only Dhruv Maharaj. I'll say something to him." So now we're beginning chapter 9. So the demigods were reassured. Everything is all right. Krishna is going to take care of the problem. And then what happened is that Dhruv Maharaj was meditating. He was seeing the Lord as described by Narada Muni, very vividly described by Narada Muni. And then all of a sudden, his meditation broke, and he wasn't able to see the Lord. But then when he opened his eyes, he saw the same Lord in front of him. The same personality of Godhead he'd been seeing within his heart was now present before him. And Prabhupada comments here that the personality of Godhead has a form that's not imaginary, it's factual. And the mature devotee, when he sees Krishna face to face, sees the same Lord that he's been worshipping all along. He's been seeing the deity in his heart, or he's been seeing the deity in the temple, and now when he becomes mature in devotional service, he sees face to face. Prabhupada said, just as we're seeing one another face to face, one can see Krishna face to face in that same form that he's been seeing all along, because the two are not different. So then the description is there, how Dhruva Maharaj was in ecstasy It wasn't just, oh, there you are. Nice to see you. Glad you haven't gone away. He was instead full of ecstasy. He felt like drinking the lotus feet of the Lord, drinking the Lord with his eyes and kissing the lotus feet of the Lord and embracing the Lord. So that was, these were all symptoms of his ecstatic realization or ecstatic feelings. Practically, it was confusing. So we get like that. Some the spiritual master appears, all of a sudden we get bewildered and we don't know what to say, and there's happiness. And there's so Dhruva Maharaj was feeling like that. And he wanted to offer prayers to the Lord, but he was stuck. Didn't know what to say, didn't know. Couldn't get it together. He was just if you see like a new speaker, he gets together. Well, I don't know what I'm going to say, and they asked me to speak, or he can't even get that far. Doesn't even want to sit there. What will I say? And he's confused. So sometimes it's like that. He was inexperienced, so he couldn't adjust himself, Prabhupada said. But then Dhruva Maharaj touched Dhruva Maharaj on the forehead. Dhruva Maharaj is standing like that with folded arms. And the Lord touches him with his conch shell, and Dhruva Maharaj becomes enlivened. And Prabhupada comments again from his realization that the devotees are eager to glorify the Lord, but sometimes they feel humble or sometimes they feel incapable. But Krishna helps from within. Dadami buddhi yogam tam. Krishna is within the heart, and Prabhupada said that when the devotee writes or speaks about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his words are dictated by the Lord from within. And Prabhupada would sometimes say that I don't, he'd read his books and say, I don't know how I've written such books. Krishna has written. So the prayers were transcendentally inspired, and Prabhupada said similarly the chanting of Hare Krishna by the devotee is transcendentally inspired. It's not a vibration of the mundane world. It's inspired by Krishna. In the next verse, the Prabhupada comments that Dhruva became perfectly aware of the Vedic conclusion and understood the Lord in relationship with the living entities. This was his good fortune. By the mercy of the Lord, he could understand everything. Vyasadeva also, in his mature state of realization, he saw the Lord along with his material energy, which was like his shadow behind him. So he understood the Lord, and he understood the potencies or energies of the Lord. This is mature realization. The Mayavadis have some realization, but it's impersonal. They don't understand the Lord and his energies. All they see is energy. So they're described in Ishopanishad as being blinded. The devotee prays, please remove the blinding effulgence so that I can see your transcendental form and understand you with your energies. Parasya Shaktir Vividayava Shriyate. The Lord has variegated energies. And understanding the Lord means understanding the Lord with his energies. Just like the king. Understanding a king means understanding the king and the king's potencies or capabilities, his potencies, his capabilities, his opulence, his wealth, his fame. That's just understanding a king without his opulence. There is no king without opulence. Opulence, king means opulent. So the personality of Godhead, or the absolute truth, is described as having various energies, vividaiva. Parasya shakti, vividaiva shruyate. So Dhruva became acquainted with all that, by just as Brahma became acquainted with all truth by the grace of the Lord, Dhruva Maharaj became enlightened by the mercy of Lord Vishnu. And just like that, he understood everything conclusively. Because he was in touch with the Lord, so the Lord is everything. Vasudeva Sarvamiti. So by coming in touch with Krishna, he'd come in touch with everything. He could understand everything perfectly by the grace of the Lord. He followed the directions of the spiritual master, and he came to the stage of ecstatic Krishna consciousness and got the mercy of Krishna so that he could offer these prayers. And Prabhupada comments again, one cannot write to glorify the Lord unless one is endowed with his causeless mercy. It's not a material activity or simply engagement of academic skills or mundane skills. It requires the mercy of the Lord. Now, how did I get into the sunshine here? Okay, I see how I got in the sunshine. I just have to move 6 inches and I'm in the shade. It's okay.
Okay?
Yeah, I'm okay here. Or you want to move this back 6 inches? Okay. Good. Good, good. Yeah, this works. Any questions so far? Okay. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To be in devotional life is the mercy of the Lord, and to be engaged in some service is Krishna's mercy. Without Krishna's mercy, it doesn't happen. So now it's described, Dhruva Maharaj begins his prayers, and he says that you've entered within me and you've enlivened all my senses. He was like a person whose senses were asleep or incapacitated. Oh, you went all the way back there? You didn't, we had this book, you didn't need to do that.
Couldn't find it
anyway. Okay. Anyway, welcome back. So, Dhruva said, you've entered in, my senses were practically asleep. Like when a person's sleeping, the senses don't do anything. So, you've entered in me and you've enlivened all of my senses. Jivanam sarva-bhuteshu. The Lord is just mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita as being the life of all living beings. So he enlivened the senses of Dhruva Maharaj so that Dhruva Maharaj could glorify him. And Prabhupada comments that Dhruva Maharaj had become like a different person. He could, before he was just a confused Hare Krishna. He was just confused, and when he became enlivened, he understood the Lord, he understood the energy of the Lord. And Prabhupada gives a very nice comment here, that the spiritual enlivenment of Dhruva Maharaj, of his senses and mind, was due to the action of the internal potency of the Lord. So, spiritual enlightenment is possible by the mercy of the spiritual energy. Chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is first addressed to the spiritual energy of the Lord, Hare. This spiritual energy acts when a living entity fully surrenders and accepts his position as an eternal servant. When a person places himself at the disposal or order of the Supreme Lord, that is called Sevan Mukha. At that time, the spiritual energy gradually reveals the Lord to him. So this is the method we were discussing yesterday, that it's not that eye exercises and you see the Lord, or you do some mechanical thing and Krishna appears. It's by the mercy of the Lord that he reveals himself to the devotee. We do service, we try to please the Lord. Even to do the service, you need the Lord's mercy. You get some mercy from the Lord, you do the service, you get some more mercy, you do more service, you get more mercy. By the internal energy. Internal energy means the energy of devotional service. Means the energy of devotional service. One becomes enlivened by the spiritual energy, the senses become purified, he engages in the service of the Lord, and in that way he continues in devotional service. In the beginning, the senses are engaged by the direction of the spiritual master and Shastra, and after realization, when the same senses are purified, the engagement continues. The difference is that in the beginning, the senses are engaged in a mechanical way, but after realization, they are engaged in spiritual understanding. So these are two stages of devotional service. There's regulated sadhana, there's regulated activity, vaidhi, by the order of the spiritual master and the shastra. And then in the advanced stage, the same activities become a source of transcendental enlivenment, and one is engaged by spiritual understanding, not just by, I got to do this, I got to do this, it says to do this, it says to do that, but he gets it. He's enlightened from within by the personality of Godhead. So Dhruva Maharaj got that. He wasn't, at first he was, what was he doing? He's doing austerities, devotional service, by the order of Narad Muni. Do this, do this, do this. So he was doing. And now? He's offering prayers. Who told him to offer prayers? Yeah, Krishna within his heart. He just got enlivened and wanted to offer prayers, and Krishna helped him. It's possible. Welcome, Atul. Hare Krishna. So now we come to quite philosophical section. We notice many times in Srimad Bhagavatam that there's storyline, as it were, there's history, and then someplace along the line, a devotee will offer prayers to the Lord. And the prayers will express philosophical understandings that we're meant to get. So here in the prayer, so we have many. Prabhupada, in fact, one time when he said, he was giving directions about what devotees should write for Back to Godhead, and he said they can write articles like prayers by Kunti, prayers by Arjun. There are different, so many different prayers, and by studying these prayers or explaining these prayers, you get the whole philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So here the Dhruva Maharaj's prayers are full of philosophical understanding. How did he become such a philosopher? 5-year-old kid. He's a kid. And now he's going to be speaking philosophy better than Shankaracharya. Better than big sages and yogis. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaj, again, 5-year-old boy. How is he speaking such philosophy? It's possible. By the empowerment given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He not only recited these prayers, they weren't recited, he understood these things, and he's speaking from his realization. Not an ordinary thing. So he's describing Ekas Tvam Eka Bhagavan Yam Atma Shaktya. You're one Supreme Personality of Godhead, and you appear differently in the material world and the spiritual world. In the material world by your external potency, and then you enter as the Super Soul, and you create various manifestations, just as fire does different things. It appears entering into wood and burns brilliantly in different ways according to what the fuel is. So Krishna, as fire appears differently in different places, Krishna appears differently through his different energies. Prabhupada comments again that this is the understanding. It's the Lord of energy. The Lord is there and his energy is there. The energy and the Lord are not separate, and at the same time, they are separate or they're different. So that understanding Guru Maharaj gives. And then Prabhupada has a little aside here. He notes that the spiritual energy of the Lord enlivens the material energy. The material energy doesn't work just on its own. It needs the spiritual energy to activate it. And we see that the dead body appears to have life force. Voidist philosophers think that under certain material conditions, the symptoms of life occur in the material body. But it's a fact that the material body cannot act on its own. Even a machine needs separate energy to work. So, of course, this is a big theme. The scientific worldview has it that matter self-organizes, and from the self-organization of matter, you get life. And Prabhupada discerned that we are, that they represent the dominant material worldview. That this scientific outlook has so much influenced the present civilization or the present world that people practically take it for granted that matter self-organizes and consciousness arises and blah, 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 blah. Without proof, without demonstration, without deep enough thought, they simply take it that matter somehow self-organizes. And Prabhupada created this Bhaktivedanta Institute among its principal purposes to challenge scientifically that materialistic worldview that matter on its own does everything. What's this compared to in Chaitanya Charitamrita? Do you know the example? How life arises from matter? There are a couple of examples, actually. Yeah. Yeah, scorpions actually. But whatever comes out of rice. That the rice is sitting there on the docks, big things of rice, and little creatures crawl out of it. And the scientist says, aha, the rice is there and the sunlight is there. And so under the mature conditions, the rice creates scorpions or worms or what have you. And the devotee or the more intelligent, informed person understands that the mother scorpion or mother worm came and laid eggs there, and by the sunlight and the heat, gestation took place, and now it's now the baby creatures are crawling out. Because life comes from life. The living being was there, and they created more living beings. Not that it matter. The other example given by Kaviraj Goswami is getting milk from the nipples on the goat's neck. Those who've observed goats around here, you've seen sometimes that they'll have little fleshy nipples on their necks, but you can't get any milk from them. They're just little bags of flesh hanging there, useless. So getting life from matter is compared to getting milk from the nipples on the goat's neck. Doesn't work. Any questions so far? Yeah? What happens next? Oh, now Dhruva Maharaj is saying, he's regretting that persons who worship you for simply for sense gratification, sense gratification means kunapopa bhogyam, to gratify the senses of this bag, kunapetri dhatuke, bag of mucus, bile, and air. They're such fools. They're influenced by your material energy. You're the cause of liberation from birth and death. And a foolish person prays to you for sense enjoyment, which you can get even in hell. Even in hell, there's some sort of material, not much, but something for sense gratification. So a foolish person prays to you. You can give liberation from birth and death. And instead, a foolish person is, what's that example that Prabhupada gives about the, you know, about the boatman who's pulling the boat along the shore? You know, do you know that example?
The guy is pulling the boat along the shore, and he's thinking that when he's made it, he'll cover the path with some cushions.
Yeah.
And, but that's, if you really made it, you wouldn't be pulling the boat.
Wouldn't be pulling the boat. But he's thinking that maybe by the grace of the Lord, I'll become a rich man and I'll have pillows lining the bank. So the foolish person is going to the Lord. There's some other story that some woman, she was carrying some heavy burden and it fell and she was praying to God, oh God, this burden has fallen. So God appeared before her, what do you want? Could you put this back on my head for me? So they're looking for that. And Dhruva Maharaj says, foolish persons, who are those foolish people? Example number one. Who does Dhruva Maharaj say is example number one of such a foolish person? Himself. That I'm such a fool that I worshipped you for these material things. Well, I could have gone to you for liberation. Instead, I'm going to you for getting a kingdom and getting revenge and all of that. So very foolish. So he's further going along those lines and saying that the happiness derived tavapada padma dhyanat, by meditating on your lotus feet or hearing about your glories, bhavaj janakata shravanena vasyat, hearing about your glories from pure devotees, it's so great that it's beyond the stage of Brahmananda. Brahmananda means the happiness of impersonal liberation. That becomes a small thing compared to the happiness of devotional service. So then, what to speak of the happiness of going to the heavenly planets? The persons who are aspiring to go to the heavenly planets are called, simple word, karmis. We say the karmis, but those people are not actually karmis. People that we meet in the street really wouldn't cut it as karmis. They don't qualify. A karmi is a person who follows the injunctions of the shastras, or you say the Bible or the Quran or some scriptural direction, so that he can get prosperity. so he can get prosperity. And when he gets prosperity, then the next thing is to enjoy. So this is their idea of religious life, that I should follow the commandments or perform the rituals, offer the prayers, attend the ceremonies, do all of these religious things, be a good person, so that I can be elevated. Elevated means that in this life, I may get the blessings of the Lord, so that I'll have health and wealth and prosperity. Or in my next life, I'll go to heaven, which they conceive, at least in, as far as I know, heaven is generally conceived not as a place where you serve. It's the place where you get the payoff. You were good, and now you're... what do they say? He's gone to his last reward. That he was a good soul, he was pious, he was a God-fearing person. Now he's gone to his last reward. So you go to heaven and you get the payoff. You get rewarded. Now you can live... Even that's not very clear what the reward is. I think in Islam they have some idea of what the reward is. Kind of... anyway, there's good sense gratification. And in a vague sort of a way, perhaps the Christians have some idea that there's whatever it is, it's good up there. Some people think it's boring to... because if your idea is not much more than clouds and people wearing old Roman outfits and playing harp music and walking around with halos over their head. Therefore, Mark Twain, the American humorist, said, heaven for piety, hell for society. At least there's some fun down here. Up there, it's boring. The Vedic literature is far more descriptive. Pushpitam Vacham, it has lots of flowery descriptions of all the good things that will be there. Divideva Bhogan, the divine enjoyments to be had in the heavenly planets, where there's beautiful surroundings and beautiful men and women and soma ras to drink and top-notch sense gratification beyond any five-star hotel in Dubai or any place else. You go to the heavenly planets and you really luck out. And you can live, not only do you luck out, but you get to live there for practically forever, for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. You can just go on enjoying. So the karmis are those pious persons who think that, well, this is much better than just trying to grab stuff from the material world and claim it as mine. I should acknowledge that it belongs to God and worship God so that I'll get a good reward. Get a good reward. So they're described here as being not very smart, because there's a happiness far greater than the happiness of the heavenly planets, which is the happiness of Brahmananda, or impersonal realization. It's far beyond the temporary happiness found in the heavenly planets. The Brahmananda is eternal happiness. So that's available. But Dhruva Maharaj says far beyond that is the happiness of devotional service. So why should people get engaged, be engaged in seeking some temporary thing? Chine punye marchu lokam vishanti. The Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that those who go to the heavenly planets after undergoing so much austerity and performing so many good deeds, charity and penance and so on, they go to the heavenly planets and then they come back down. When their piety is exhausted, back down they come. There's something like, again, you go to Dubai, you're spending a few hundred dollars a day on hotel room and then restaurants and taxi fares, and apart from your plane fare. So every day your capital is decreased. So your time is running out. Finally, you're out of money. So you have to go back to Arkansas or someplace and go back to work. to get some more money so that you can go on vacation again. So it's something like that. While you're in the heavenly planets, you're using up your punya. And when it's exhausted, punya kshine, martyalokam dushanti, then you have to come back down to earth again and pick up where you left off. So, gatagatam kama kama lapante. Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. Gatagatam, coming and going. So what's the point? Just that, all right, it's a long time you get to spend there, but you have to come back, so what's the use? That's his point. And Prabhupada gives the example of the astronauts who fly up and then they use up their fuel and they have to come back down again. From the impersonal liberation, same thing. Not that their piety is exhausted, but sooner or later they can't stick it out any longer in the impersonal artificial state, so they come back down. Any questions so far? Okay. So now Dhruva Maharaj says, Bhaktim Muhu Prabhatam Twayi Me Prasango. Please give me this blessing that I can associate with the great devotees who are always engaged in your devotional service constantly. They're actually pure, free from all contamination. And by devotional service, I'll be able to cross over the ocean of material existence. And that will be very easy because I'm becoming mad after that. Neshye bhavad guna katam ritapana matta. I'm becoming mad to drink the transcendental qualities of devotional service. Prabhupada said this is the purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement. He wrote some letter to one of our chief managers, I think, at the time, and said we should never forget our purpose in this society, which is to become mad after Krishna. That's our purpose, to become mad after Krishna. That's the purpose. That we should never forget our purpose, which is to become mad after Krishna. In the purport, Prabhupada has an often quoted statement. Anyone who's trying to be aloof, first Prabhupada explains that without the association of devotees, you really can't serve. That Dhruva Maharaj wanted that association, and it can't be without the association of devotees, devotional service will not be complete, will not be relishable. And that's why Prabhupada started the society, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And then Prabhupada famously says, anyone who is trying to be aloof from this Krishna Consciousness Society and yet engage in Krishna consciousness is living in a great hallucination, for this is not possible. Interesting quotation. What do you make of that?
I often wonder about, you know, the circumstances when Prabhupada said it and the circumstances now, and they could be kind of different. And then it was probably there was only Prabhupada's society in ISKCON, and there wasn't really much other facility for Krishna conscious development. And so now, you know, that could be argued that that may not be the case now.
What do you think of that? Do you think of that? I argue, yes?
Some people may hear it now and say, I've heard this argument that anyone who's trying to be aloof from this Krishna conscious society, so they say, well, actually, we are in the Krishna conscious society, because it's coming, we start with Srila Prabhupada, and therefore,
Yeah, you can tell them. I got it. Just be loud. Loud. You didn't hear him? You weren't loud enough either. Well, who are the other groups? There are people, we can be explicit, there are people who are affiliated with Srila Sridhar Maharaj. There are almost always former ISKCON devotees, or sometimes people who've joined by their groups by the influence of former ISKCON devotees. There are people associated with Srila Narayan Maharaj, with Srila Sridhar Maharaj, with Srila Pudi Maharaj, with other Gaudiya Vaishnav groups, or with some sort of a ISKCON breakaway. They're not affiliated with any other group, but they have some disagreement with ISKCON. So there was Siddhasrupananda. His group is still there, but not really affiliated with ISKCON. There might be others that I, small little pockets that I don't know about, or bigger ones I'm not thinking of. There's a lot of people out there. There are the Ritvik people, of course, who they're in a special category because they have a very different philosophical conclusion. Most of these other groups have the same philosophy that you hear in an ISKCON class. So those are the people that we're talking about, yeah?
My sort of understanding on the topic is that quite clearly Srila Prabhupada was chosen.
Okay, that's the comeback, or that's the way that the quotation is usually given. That International Society for Krishna Consciousness means International Society for Krishna Consciousness, founded in 1966 or whatever it was, by Srila Prabhupada, and having the Governing Body Commission as its ultimate managing authority, and that's ISKCON, and anything else is clearly stated here to be illusory.
Can I respond to Nandrabha? I like the point Nandrabha made about, you know, the kind of the uniqueness of Prabhupada's contribution in our sampradaya and its history. And Prabhupada's established, you know, means by which Krishna consciousness was effectively spread all over the world. But actually, if you could analyze a lot of the other groups, they're reflecting in their activities and their teachings a lot of Prabhupada's teachings, because they've been influenced by ISKCON's preaching and by Prabhupada's books and by their membership. So a lot of the principles of Prabhupada's success formula are reflected in these other institutes.
That's also there.
So, you know, it's not that we can kind of completely divorce that everything is wrong, because a lot of the things they're doing are actually in line with Prabhupada's teachings.
For that matter, whether you like it or not, a lot of things from other mutts are in ISKCON these days. What do you make of that, then? What happens to this argument? Does it fly? Does it not fly?
What is the argument we see in something like that anything else is ISKCON is not modified?
It may be bona fide or not, but if you're living apart from ISKCON, you're living in a hallucination, which is essentially implying that it's not bona fide, sure. If you're apart from ISKCON, which Prabhupada said, we have founded, wasn't that the previous sentence? We have founded the International Society. Anyone who's trying to live apart from this society is living in a hallucination.
Another comment I have serving in ISKCON and unhappy in ISKCON, supporting the mission, affiliated with the Institute. But I would personally find it difficult to kind of push this argument.
Why?
Just because I just, I wouldn't have that conviction, because the reason that I mentioned earlier, that I couldn't say that, I couldn't say that everything they do is kind of useless.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't kind of like present that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry? Well, that's essentially what you'd have to argue. You'd have to say, if you're living outside of ISKCON, you're living in hallucination. If you're living in a hallucination, that's not very conducive to going back to Godhead. So if you're in ISKCON, you can go back to Godhead. If you were associated with any of these other societies or groups, well, tough luck. You get to go to Hallucination Loco or something. Yeah, maybe you could say that somehow or other. Although I don't know, if you come out of your hallucination at some point, you can join ISKCON and then you can go back to Godhead. Have you heard this quote used that way? Or is it just me and the tool? Yes? No?
I haven't heard it in about 15 years. But, maybe others have heard it. But I used to hear it a lot.
You used to hear it more often.
Yeah.
It's still pulled out now and then. I would have difficulty, as you would, because you look at Prabhupada's reasons. His reasoning is that you have to associate with pure devotees. How can you perform devotional service outside the association of devotees? It's an illusion. You need that association, or you can't make progress. And there, Prabhupada says, therefore we've founded this society. And if you're outside the society, you're in Maya. You're going to live in illusion. You're just imagining that you can advance without the association of devotees. This would be around 1970, 73, 74?
What was the spiritual condition of this world at that time?
Of the world?
Was ISKCON basically the only...
Yeah, basically we were the only game in town. In the West, we had an exclusive monopoly on Krishna consciousness. If you went to America, if you went to Africa, if you went to Europe, if you went to Australia, if you went anywhere other than India and maybe a little bit of Nepal and Bangladesh, it was ISKCON or nothing. And even if you came to India, it was basically, in most parts of India, if you went outside of Bengal, except for a couple of select locations, it was ISKCON or nothing. And even if you went to various other institutions, you probably wouldn't get much happening for you. Even if you got somebody speaking your language, you'd be doing very well. What to speak of getting any kind of guidance and so on. So effectively, ISKCON was the only game in town. Then we have a vastly different situation now.
I've been doing editing on this profile that much. Going back to yesterday's lecture, has the time, place, and circumstances changed?
Looks to me like it has. The time is very different. Prabhupada's no longer here, among other things. All sorts of things have happened in ISKCON and around ISKCON, outside of ISKCON. ISKCON has in some ways changed. Other spiritual organizations have sprung up or developed, some of them with a large influx of energy from ISKCON. They picked up, as Atul Krishna Prabhu said, a lot of the ideas and practices of ISKCON or Krishna consciousness as adapted or tailored by ISKCON has been assimilated by other groups and being spread. So the time is certainly different. Place hasn't changed all that much. It's still the same world. and circumstances have changed a lot. It was ISKCON or nothing. Now it's, well, what would you like? ISKCON or Navadvip or Mathura or this one or that one. There's lots and lots of choices out there. And I would find it difficult, personally, to argue from this that if you're associated with any other spiritual leaders or any other spiritual society, well, then you're not associated with Krishna consciousness, because we have it within the walls of our ISKCON compounds, and outside, it's just you're imagining that you have Krishna. You're chanting the same mantra, you're coming in the same general line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, not through Prabhupada, but through some other apparently authorized representative of the same sampradaya. You're reading the same books, you're following the same acharyas, you've reached the same devotional conclusions, you're worshipping the same deities, but where in reality and you're in illusion? I would find that difficult to defend. Well, I might make greater distinctions than between Coke and Pepsi. It might be something like between, different, depending on, there are a lot of flavors out there. And, you know, some of them might really be junk food. Some of them might be healthy. Some of them might be tasty. Some of them might be tasteless. So it might be a little bit more than Coke and Pepsi, which are essentially indistinguishable. But I think it's a lot different from Coke or an illusion of Coke. You know, when you think you're drinking something, but it's not really there. Now, I might want to be in ISKCON for other reasons. Other reasons than, well, it's either this or hallucination. I might have other good reasons for preferring to be in. You mentioned some reasons that you might prefer to be in ISKCON. So I think that we're going to fare better if we have good arguments rather than arguments that sound good or don't even sound good, that someone can look at and you know, say, oh, come on. You're still beating that old drum. It can also be used, by the way, as you stay under my control or you're living in a hallucination. At its worst, it becomes like that. You keep collecting for me and serving my purposes or helping advance my agenda. Otherwise, you're living in a hallucination, a sort of a threat device. But as it's usually employed as an argument for why you would make more spiritual progress here than there, I don't find it impressive. Maybe that's why it's sort of gone out of fashion. You don't hear it as much anymore. A lot of listeners may have concluded that it doesn't really, you don't score. You can quote it if you want, but and you can believe it, but it's not going to make a big impression on me because I can see the context of the argument and I have no problem saying yes, Prabhupada is speaking more generically or he's speaking specifically, but it can be applied generically because of the different circumstances. So I would look for other reasons why I would prefer to be in ISKCON, assuming I prefer to be in ISKCON. And I might also not use it as a way to hit people over the head who've chosen a different thing to do. You must be living in a hallucination. I'm living in reality, and you are living in hallucination. Amanina amanadena tirtaniya sadhani. Anything more on this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that we have Srila Prabhupada. Even that would have to be qualified. I don't know that we've locked Prabhupada up in our temples and he can't get out. But certainly ISKCON is that organization which exclusively strives to follow the line from Srila Prabhupada. We take Srila Prabhupada as our prime authority on spiritual matters, our prime guide in Krishna consciousness. We take his orders as being the orders that we have to follow. We take his method of presentation as the method of presentation that we should accept. Basically, we say we're Prabhupada men. We're interested in serving his society because it's his society. In so many ways, we're dedicated to Srila Prabhupada, which, with a few exceptions maybe, which most other groups would not be able to say. Perhaps they might say, well, I'm devoted to Srila Prabhupada, and I get something that helps my service to Prabhupada over here. But whatever it is over here, it's not an institution exclusively dedicated to carrying out Srila Prabhupada's orders. They have their own acharyas, they have their own spiritual leaders. Those spiritual leaders have their own understandings and priorities and methods of presentation, their own emphasis, their own brand, you can say, of Krishna consciousness. And they're not obliged to follow Prabhupada. They haven't made a contract. They haven't sworn eternal fidelity to Prabhupada. So they can take it or leave it, or take some and leave some, and do things as they see fit. And that's their prerogative. It's not there in Bhagavad Gita, you have to follow Prabhupada or you can't be Krishna conscious. But we may believe that there's special advantage in following Srila Prabhupada, that Srila Prabhupada's society offers special advantages because of being exclusively dedicated to carrying out his instructions. We may see that as a reason why we prefer to be in ISKCON. And we might have other reasons. And there might be reasons why people might say, you know, for all of that, still I don't want to be in ISKCON. I want to be someplace else. That's their choice. Yeah, it's, you know, as they say, a free country or free world. Everyone has choice. And one thing is, presenting Krishna consciousness in the modern world, we have to recognize that people have free choice. You can't really box off, you know, what is that word, hermetically seal. They have those tin cans that are, it comes from Hermes, the god who is the tinker or the blacksmith, really, of the Greek gods, Hermes. And he was responsible, essentially, for the modern tin cans that seal the freshness in and the contamination out, you know. Yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada was very particular. He didn't want us going here and there, Radhakund, and hearing from these Babajis and those people. Even with his godbrothers, he was careful. So all of these things are there. I'm just saying that we have to recognize that we may have these views, but in the larger world, people have choice. You have your idea of what's best for them to do. Somebody else has another idea of what's best for them to do. And it's going to be very hard for you to, especially as the world goes on, to arrange things in such a way that they never find out that there's anybody else out there spreading Krishna consciousness. It's hard to do that. How would Prabhupada react? I'm not going to speculate. How Prabhupada, if he were to appear today, would react to the changed circumstances, which they definitely are. When Prabhupada was here, it was a whole different environment in terms of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. In terms of the materialistic world in general, it hasn't changed all that much. But in terms of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it's very much changed. You go to so many countries in the world, and there are Hare Krishna temples that have nothing to do with ISKCON. There are people distributing books that have nothing to do with ISKCON. There are people distributing ISKCON books, you know, buying books from the BBT. And
everything
has to do with pretty much. I heard one Gaudiya Vaishnava. He attended a program that I attended in America, and I really liked him because he didn't say anything about having any connection with Prabhupada. It would have actually been very difficult for him to make a case for having a connection with Prabhupada. And he didn't. You know, he had his little flyers of the Gaudiya Math that he was associated with, and he spoke about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and so on, but he kind of didn't really say more than a word or two about Prabhupada. Because he really didn't have any, there's no special connection between him and Prabhupada. Others, you know, very much tell us about their relationship with Prabhupada and what Prabhupada said to them or what role they played in relationship to Prabhupada. This particular person didn't. You know, it's just Krishna consciousness, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and so on. So that's the world these days. We're not the only show in town. And it's just a reality that we have to face or deal with or operate in, that we are not the only choice. It's like Coca-Cola, you know, they were the only choice. If you wanted one of those murky-looking, caffeinated, bubbly drinks, you went out and bought a Coke. It was as simple as that, and all you had to do was spread the glories of Coke and sell more and more. And then the Pepsi people came up and gradually gathered market share, and now it's like
everybody
makes cola. Yeah, I mean, and you know, Coke will say we're the original, and so on. But their marketing strategy has to change now. They have to tell you not only why they're refreshing and so on, but why they're better than Pepsi. Or they have to at least be there first, or be out in front more. Yeah, from that point of view, it's also, that's what happens when you're in a multi-vendor environment. You know, when people can only buy from one supplier, that supplier can basically sit on his butt. He can sit comfortably and wait for the customers to come and give them bad service and lousy products and, you know, whatever it is, because the customer can't go anyplace else. I can charge you high prices. I can do whatever I want because, you know, you want it or you don't. If you want it, you have to come to me. If you don't want it, okay. But when somebody else sets up a shop next door and someone else down the road and someone else across the street, now I have to be nicer to my customers. I have to give very good products. I have to package them nicely. I have to offer good service with a smile. I offer follow-up and send you little cards and say, you know, is it still working nicely and do you need a new one? Because I'm now in competition. So it's not necessarily bad to be in competition. But whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, we are now in a competitor, if you call it competitive, or at least in an environment where the buyers have choice. You can tell them why your product is better, and they may or may not agree with it. Or they may say, I like your product, but I hate your salesman. You know, your salesman treated me so bad that even though you have a better product, I'm still going to buy the other guys. Buy from the other guy. Yeah, therefore you have to become pure devotee. Therefore you have to become a pure devotee. Then people will meet you and they'll say, oh. Otherwise, if we're not pure devotees, if we're impure devotees or not devotees, then it won't have the same effect. So yeah, now it's on us. We can't just be slouching. We have to do something. Otherwise, we don't do it, the next guys will do it. And the next guys doesn't mean necessarily our followers. They mean the guys down the street. They'll get the credit.
So we can lose our members.
Yeah, your own members may say, you know, I joined because you used to give great service and had tremendous products and a friendly atmosphere. And these days, you know, the product's kind of not that hot, and the service stinks, and your salesmen treat me bad, and I can't get any follow-up, and they're offering me a 20% discount down the street, and a 10-year guarantee, and a 10-year warranty, and, 5% extra, whatever it is. So, it's been great, but Maribel, that's another aspect of a multiplicity. Everybody has to work harder, or else lose.
From a different angle, stated by this, has there been any discussions from the publishers about the possibility of footnotes in Prabhupada's books to deal with the sort of, you know, a statement like this?
To deal with something like this?
Yeah, a statement like that.
No, not even slightly. We did our footnote thing earlier this year. I think you all know about that. Girls are okay. There's nothing bad about them. Footnote one, we love them. Footnote two, they're really great. Footnote three, and they're as good as everybody else. Footnote four, and Prabhupada didn't really mean what he says over here. Footnote five, and he meant it, but he meant it this way. Footnote six, and we said, bah. Not going to do that, because then, you know, we'll have to do footnotes about all sorts of things. They didn't go to the moon, footnote 42. Darwin's a bum, footnote 47. Living in hallucination, footnote 142. Footnote, footnote, footnote. So we decide we're not going to do that. We do have a website, bbt.info. where you can find essays written by devotees on some of the controversial points that might be footnoted if we were going to do footnotes. So tough ones. That's what it is, right? Tough ones. Tough questions. What about these things in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada bashes his godbrothers? What about position of women? What about this rape thing? What about that? So some of those questions, and more will be forthcoming, are dealt with in the tough ones section of BBT Info, right? Okay. So you can see those things there. Yeah. We haven't taken our break. Should we take our break? Okay, you get 10 minutes. 10 minutos. That's, I don't know what is minuti, yeah. 10 minutos is Spanish. Okay. See you in, 28 after.
So Swayam will be taking over.
Swayam's taking over your job, huh?
Yeah, at one.
When are you leaving?
Anytime after now and anytime before 3.
Wow.
So I was supposed to leave at midnight, but Kiramakan Maharaj said, no, don't leave in the night.
No.
Tomorrow Krishna Maharaj left on the similar circumstance.
Yeah, don't do that.
So I thought, no, maybe I'll spend the night over at our Kolkata temple at least.
Hmm.
But Kolkata is Prabhupada's town.
Very much.
I like this one. This was a nice
subject.
Yeah, I don't know. I like rocking the apple cart. So these sort of things, they float my boat.
Yeah, this is fun stuff.
It's nice to see it in context, though.
Yeah. It is. Well, thank you for your all service.
Wow.
Maybe I'll see you in South Africa.
Yeah. Do you you know when you might get the travel arrangements together?
Nah.
Yeah. If you give, like, usually it comes on a month before you arrive, right?
Something like that.
Something like
get
that.
Get on Grujesu's case to get on my case.
Oh, okay.
To put my travel schedule together.
Oh, it's within South Africa. It's not like I have to get a visa or something like that.
Hmm?
It's within South Africa, so it doesn't. I don't need to get a visa.
You don't need to get the visa. No.
Visa. I just need to, like, you know, can I take a week off now, boss? And she's not so bad with me sometimes.
Okay.
So, like that. Yeah, I know Krishna will make arrangements. I'm not anxiety.
Good, good.
Thank you so much for time. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Get my chapter in here. Arjuna Vacha, Kim Tad Brahma, Kim Adhyatmam, Kim Karma, Purushottamam, Adi Putam, Chakim Proktam, Adi Daivam, Kim Uchite, Adi Yagya, Katam Kotra, Dehesmin Madhusudana, Prayana Kale, Chakatam, Gayosi, Niyatatma Pi, Sri Bhagavan Vacha, Akshanam Brahma, Padamam, Subhavo Dhyatmam Uchite, Bhuta Pavo Tavakaro Visarga Karma Sangitaha Adhi Bhutam Kshoro Bhava Purushas Jati Daivatam Adhi Yagyoham Evatra Dehe Deha Vratam Vara Antakale Tamam Eva Smaran Muktva Kalevanam Ya Prayati Samadbhavam Yati Nasyat Vashangshayaha Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajitante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kanteya sadatad bhava bhavataha tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mamanu smara yudhyacha mayarpata mano buddhir mami vaishasya sanshayaha abhyasa yoga yuktena chetasana nyagamina Paramam Purusham Divyam Yati Parthanu Chintayam Kavim Puranam Manushashitaram Anoraniyam Samanusmarejaha Savasya Dhatanam Chintya Rupam Aditya Varnam Tamasa Parastat Prayana Kale Manasa Chalena Bhaktya Yukto Yoga Palena Shaiva Bhruvor Madhye Pranam Avesha Samyak Satam param purusham upaiti divyam Yadakshanam veda vido varanti vishanti yad yatayo vita raga Yad ichchanto brahmacharyam charanti Tate padam sangrahena pravakshe Sarvadwarani sanyamya mano hiddhi nirudhyacha Murinyadhayatmana pranam astito yogataranam Om ityekaksharam brahma vyaharam mamanusmaran yaprayati jajandeham sayati paramam gatim ananya cheta satatam yomam smarati nityashaha tasyaham sulabha partha nitya yuktasya yoginaha mam upecha punarjanma dukkhalayam shashvatam napnuvanti mahatmanaha Sansidhim paramam gataha Abramha bhuvana loka Punar avartinurjana Mamupecha tukanteya Punar janma navidyate Sahasra yuga paryantam Aharyad brahmano viduhu Ratrim yuga sahasrantam Teho ratra vido janaha Avyaktad vyaktaya sarva Prabhavant yaharagame Ratriagame praliyante tatraivavyakasangyake bhutagrama saevayam bhutva bhutva praliyate Ratriagame vashaparta prabhavatyaharagame padastasmatubhavonyo vyakto vyaktatsanatanaha yasa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu na vinashyati Avyaktokshareityuktastamahu paramam gatim yam prapyana nivartante tadhama paramam mama purushasa paraparta bhaktya labhyastvananyaya yasyantakstani bhutani yena sarvam idam tatam yatra kale tvana vrittim avrittim chaiva yoginaha prayata yanti tam kalam vakshami varatarshabha agnir jyotiraha shukla shanmasa uttarayanam tatra prayata gacchanti brahma brahma vido janaha dhumo ratristata krishna shanmasa dakshinayanam tatra chandramasam jyotir yogi prapya nivartate shukla krishne gati yete jagata shashvate mate ekaya yatyana vrittim anyaya vartate punaha naite shruti parta janan yogi muyati kashchana tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yukto bhavarjana vedeshu yageshu tapashu jaiva daneshu yat punya padam pradishtam atyeti tat sarvam idam viditva yogi param sthanam upayati chajam. Om tat sadati Srimad Bhagavad Gita Upanishad Su Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastre Krishna Arjuna Samvade. Brahmataraka Yoga Nama Ashtamodhyaya. Thank you. I'm all set, though. Thank you very much. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Okay, we start again. So Dhruv Maharaj is glorifying the Lord. He mentions that if someone becomes attached to devotional service, he loses attachment for home and family and friends and wealth and all of that, which all the materialists are busy cultivating. He becomes uninterested. He loses interest because he becomes interested in Krishna, not in this body and the associations concerned with the body. He knows that material things come and go, but that the form of the Lord is eternal. He glorifies the Lord in different ways, offering very nice philosophical prayers, which we don't have time to study. The format of this course allows us to zip through a chapter in a day or two. And so you really don't get the sort of depth that you would get by studying the chapter, as we would in the Srimad Bhagavatam class, reverse a day. Or as you might on your own, really studying a chapter and mining it for all of its value. So we're going to skip through a fair amount of stuff just because, that's the way it's been handed to us and what the time allows. But on your own, you can either sooner or later go through these prayers by Dhruv Maharaj and find a lot of good stuff. So he offers his prayers, and I'm going to go through them that fast, that there they are, read them, study them, find good things there. And then when he finished, the satsangkalpena, prayers offered by Dhruv Maharaj, who had good intentions, satsangkalpena, the Lord was pleased and spoke to him. And he said, well, I know what your desire is, and in fact, it's very ambitious and very difficult to fulfill, but you came to the right place, so I will fulfill your desires. And the Lord knew that in spite of being awarded these material benedictions, Dhruv Maharaj would remain fixed in devotional service. In the beginning, he was only interested in the material benedictions. Now, in fact, he's really only interested in devotional service. But the Lord is also going to award him the material things that he desired. And here's how the Lord solves the problem. The problem is that Dhruva wants a kingdom greater than his great-grandfather's, and his great-grandfather's in charge of the whole universe. So what do you give to fulfill that desire? It's something of a problem. Brahma's already got the whole universe. So the Lord says, yes, I've got something for you. I've got a particular planet called, now called Dhruvaloka, which is the pole star. In ordinary astronomy, the pole star is that central star around which all the other stars are seen to revolve. Seen to revolve because it depends on your point of view, and there's a whole scientific story about what's where and what's moving which way and so on. But if you just take your ordinary vision, not so ordinary because you have to study it, but those who've studied it, astronomers and so on, they'll see that the stars and their constellations are moving around in a circle around the pole star. The pole star is always in the same place. And Venus, well, not Venus, but the planets like Venus and so on, and these various stars, the Big Dipper, Little Dipper, all this kind of stuff. Sometimes it's over here, sometimes it's over there, sometimes it's over there, sometimes it's over there. Right? Yeah, they move around. If you look in the newspapers where they still talk about this stuff, sometimes if they have a little column, they'll say, look for the Little Dipper in such and such place. Look for this in such and such place as the seasons change, because the stars are moving around. But they never have to tell you where the pole star is. It's always, what, more or less due north. It's always up at the top there. And it's the brightest, and all the others are moving around it. So that star, according to the Vedic astronomy, is called Dhruvaloka. And here the Lord says that this Dhruvaloka is not like the other stars and planets in the universe, but it's actually a Vaikuntha planet. It's actually an eternal planet situated within the universe. And it's not destroyed when the other planets are destroyed. Something like a Vaikuntha embassy. It's beyond the laws, as the American embassy in India is not governed by Indian laws, it's governed by its own laws. So the Vaikuntha planet within this universe, Dhruvaloka, is not affected by the material laws. Even the destruction of the universe doesn't affect it. So all the stars, and it's described nicely, that all the other stars circle around Dhruvaloka like bulls. You've seen how they'll have a bull moving around in a circle around that central post, and the grains are there, and the bull is crushing the grains, moving around in a circle. So as the bulls are moving around in a circle, in a similar way, the stars are encircling Dhruvaloka. And the various stars, some of them have various sages, Dharma, Agni, and so on. So they're all circumambulating Dhruvaloka. So you'll get Dhruvaloka, you'll get this planet, and your father is going to go to the forest and give you his kingdom, and you'll be in charge of the kingdom for 36,000 years. Satya Yuga, you can live for a long time. You'll be in charge of the kingdom for 36,000 years, and your senses will be as strong as they are now. Generally, if I told you you could live for 36,000 years, you'd say, oh, God. To be 110 or something like that, you just picture decrepitude and walking with also, orthopedic devices and just a whole miserable situation. But the Lord tells Guru Maharaj, you'll have 36,000 years and your senses will be fully capable for all that time. You'll never get old. So it's quite a good deal. And your brother sometime in the future is going to go hunting. He'll be killed. His mother is going to go looking for him. She'll die in a forest fire. Because the Lord knew that Dhruva basically had it in for his stepmother. That there was a revengeful spirit there. I'll show her and I'll... So there was a certain spirit of revenge that she was like an enemy, practically speaking. She was the one who blocked him. So the Dhruva felt some resentment against his stepmother. And so the Lord would also take care of that. He would kill the brother and the stepmother. And you'll be able to give charity and do big, big sacrifices while you're the king. And at the time of death, you'll be able to remember me. That's the most important thing. Ante mam samsmarishyasi. You'll have all of this great stuff. You'll have super facility for power. This is Kshatriya's dream. You'll have the kingdom for 36,000 years. You'll have full power of your senses. You'll get this super ultra planet. Your enemies are going to be finished. So he's really, you'll be able to do big time sacrifices and distribute charity like anything. And at the end, you'll go back to Godhead because you'll think of me. Ante mam samsmarishasi. Antakale chamam evam smaran muktva kalevram. Yap prayati samadbhavam. What is that? Madbhavam? Yanti. Yati natyastrasham shayaha. At the time of death, if you think of me, then definitely you'll come back to me. So that's the guarantee being given to Dhruva Maharaj. And finally, you'll come back to my own abode in the spiritual sky. You'll be there in the spiritual sky after leaving your material body. Spiritual sky means Dhruva Loka is in the spiritual sky, even in the material world. So then, Lord Vishnu takes off. He gets on Garuda. Garuda flies away. They head back toward Vaikuntha, and Dhruva Maharaj is watching the Lord leave. And then Dhruva Maharaj returns home, but he's feeling lousy. He's feeling displeased or despondent. And so Vidura says, well, after getting all of this, all these assurances and blessings from the Lord, why was he despondent? And Maitreya is answering that he was despondent because he was aggrieved by the harsh words of his stepmother, and he wanted to show her and couldn't forget about how she'd insulted him. And so when the Lord himself appeared before him, he wanted material benedictions instead of wanting to get out of material existence and attain liberation or go back to Godhead. He had these material demands in mind, and even demonic sort of spirit, to think in terms of friends and enemies and so maya hata shatru harishye chaparanapi. He's my enemy and I've killed him, I'll kill my other enemies also. This is a demonic spirit. So Dhruva Maharaj is thinking, I had these demonic feelings in my heart toward my stepmother and my brother, and I wanted material things, and so when I could have gotten liberation, instead I'm stuck here. The great benediction. You have to stay 36,000 years in the material world. The world. I should have met the Lord, and after meeting the Lord by the grace of my spiritual master, that should have been it. I should have gone back to Godhead. Instead, he gave me a blessing. Yeah, you can stay here for 36,000 years in the material world and have lots of sensory power and lordship over this and that. So how unfortunate. How unfortunate that I wanted these things. I basically wanted to dominate the material world. That's the materialistic spirit, to control. So I wanted to be a big controller in the material world, and that's what I got. Instead of getting liberation, all right, I'll get it eventually, but look what I'm stuck with. What other people might think, wow, he's thinking, unfortunately. It's so hard to get the darshan of the Lord, and I got it within 6 months, and then this is how I was so unfortunate. that I had these revengeful aspirations and materialistic aspirations. So I prayed for these perishable things. And Prabhupada cautions us, in Krishna consciousness, we should be completely free from all miserable, all material aspirations. Otherwise, we will have to lament like Dhruva Maharaj. That we should aspire for, pure devotional service. And not to be, which is, you know, sounds easy on the surface, but what actually happens in practice? We want this, we want that, we have this aspiration, that aspiration. One has to seriously cultivate Krishna consciousness to be jnana karmadhyana avrita, free from these material desires. Any questions so far? He got the mercy of Krishna. He performed austerities. He got the mercy of Narad Muni. He got to see the Lord personally. The Lord touched him with his conch shell. So he completely changed. He was a new man. Different consciousness from... He was just an offended little boy. And he became a great sadhu. A great devotee. Okay? And he thinks that it must be that the demigods must have influenced me, because the demigods influence everything that happens in, with our bodies and our minds. The demigods get their ends there at different places. They're in charge of... You can't move your eyebrows without the demigod in charge of your eyebrows. So he thinks, well, the demigods, they were just to keep me down. They've influenced me in this way. In other words, it's adidaivik miseries. These miseries have been brought on by the demigods. I was thinking in terms of friends and enemies. I was thinking that my brother was my enemy. This materialistic mentality. So I've met the Lord and I've prayed for material useless things. So my activities, he said, were exactly like treatment given to a person who's already dead. Medical treatment given to a person who's dead doesn't do very much. So he said, that's the result of my activities. I met the Supreme Lord, who could have given liberation from birth and death, and I prayed for more birth and death, essentially. If I'm praying for material things, I'm praying to stay here. Danam janam sundarim. If I'm praying, I want money, I want followers, I want a beautiful wife. That means I want to stay here. Because I have to stay to come back to enjoy these things. So that's his situation. Then very vividly he says that I'm just like the poor man who goes to a big rich man and asks for a handful of rice. I'm just like that. Imagine you go to a big, big rich man and he can give you anything you want. And you say, can I have a palmful of rice? Or he's gone to Lord Vishnu and he's asked for some paltry material things. Then he says the pure devotees don't do that. They never ask for material prosperity. They just want to taste the honey from the lotus feet of the Lord. Now the sun shifts again. King Uttanapada hears that Dhruva Maharaj is coming back. So he's doubting, how is it possible? But he hears from Narada. So he had faith in Narad Muni. And he got a messenger came and said, yes, he's coming. So the king was overjoyed. And he goes out with a golden chariot and with all the ministers and government officials and family members and a big party with drums and flutes and a whole parade to greet his returning son, Dhruva Maharaj. And his queens and Dhruva's brother also come in the party, and Prabhupada mentions that Suniti, the mother of Dhruva Maharaj, was not envious that now my son has attained success, so hell with you. Instead, yes, you also come. So she was also a saintly person. So the king goes out and embraces his son, and Dhruva Maharaj offers his obeisances to his father and to his two mothers, both. Now he's purified. At first he was resentful and revengeful. Now he's equally respectful to both of his mothers. And his mother particularly was so gratified, so happy that the boy has come back. And it's described someplace, I'm not exactly on the page, that because she was also praying to the Lord. Dhruva was worshiping the Lord, but she was staying home at the palace. She was also praying to the Lord for the welfare of her son. So she was also a fortunate devotee. So she embraces him, milk flowing from her breast, so it's like an Abhishek ceremony. And all of the residents of the palace praise her, that you're so fortunate that your son was lost and now he's come back, and it seems that he's going to put an end to all of your material miseries. So Prabhupada comments, no, that's where this comment was, about her devotion to the Lord. So everyone's praising Dhruva Maharaj. The king is very happy also. The whole city is decorated, and it's described how opulent the city was, how the jewels and the cloth and the huge arrangements. Even today in India, sometimes you can see when there's a big festival, they'll put up so many gates and so many decorations and so many things. And they did so when Dhruva Maharaj came back. Fruits and flowers and garlands and mango leaves and all of these things that still today you can see, along with a lot of stuff you don't see, like lots of golden ornaments and pearls and jewels and all that sort of stuff that Prabhupada comments were part of the ancient Indian civilization. He said now they make this stuff out of plastic and aluminum. But in those days, it was gold. Even now, you know, you go to a house of a well-to-do person, and the plates are plastic or clay, or they're some kind of, plastic or pottery usually. Plastic or china. China is considered great stuff. China in India means pottery. You use it once and throw it out. It can't be cleaned. It's for one-shot use. But in the West, if a person's very rich, he has pottery that he was handed down from his great-grandfather. Or else they've got plastic, which, ugh, awful stuff. But back in the old days, gold and even the banana leaves are of a very high standard compared to plastic. So they had lots of fruits and flowers and grains and wealthy things, valuable jewels like sapphires, all of this stuff. Prabhupada comments, you can still see some of the remnants of these things. If you go to the Red Fort in New Delhi, you can see the places where they pulled the jewels out to send them to the British Museum. And if you go to the British Museum, you can see the crown jewels, I suppose, and big stuff, which is basically all hauled out of India. They don't have sapphire mines and all of that, and the British Isles, they pulled all that stuff from here. So India was very, very wealthy, and Indian civilization back in those days was very wealthy, not on the basis of big motor cars. Advancement of human civilization depends not on industrial enterprises, but on possession of natural wealth and natural food, which is all supplied by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so that we may save time for self-realization and success in the human form of life. That was the idea, not just big advancement. I mean, you go to these places, and it's all tin and concrete and aluminum and smog and fog and rum, 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 rum. And this is advancement. This is advancement. So it's really backwards advancement. The real advancement was, well, more like Mayapur. There's, you know, lots of firewood, and there's grains, and there's vegetables, and there's trees with fruits, and you can still hear birds singing, and there's fresh air, and there's the Ganga next door, and, you know, where would you rather live? That or Park Avenue? Even Central Park, Central Park South means, you know, you're on big fancy address in New York City, Central Park South. But, you know, it's just a park. Compared to this whole place, is, you know, you could fit Central Park in one corner of Mayapur. And Central Park is surrounded by all rubbish. And, in fact, filled with all sorts of rubbish, too. But Mayapur is such a beautiful and wonderful place. So that's the real standard of advancement. It'll be something of a challenge to keep Mayapur from being infested with the reverse advancement of modern civilization. Be a challenge for those who are our Mayapur leaders. So then they made Dhruva Maharaj the king, and Uttanapada, considering that his son was there now on the throne and his old age had arrived, took off. He left for the forest. Consider that. People, the modern politicians, they're the governor of some miserable state filled with all sorts of rubbish and debt and scandals and problems and disgruntled citizens and all of that. And they want to stay there till their dying day. And here's King Uttanapada, who's got a kingdom filled with palaces and jewels and chariots and gold and grain stuck to the ceiling and everything you might want. And he says, okay, old age has come, time to get out. So he had, that's the actual advancement, not that I heap up tons of grubby materialistic stuff and hang on to it and like a miser till I'm kicked out by death. But instead that I have these natural things, they're really meant to help me in devotional service and spiritual realization, and when the time comes, I kiss it all goodbye and go off to the forest and head back to Godhead. That was real advancement. Okay, any questions in the last couple of minutes left? Krishna is kind. And the boy got the blessings of Narad Muni. And he practiced very seriously. Yasyadeve prabhakti yatadeve kitagura. Great faith in the Lord and the spiritual master he sincerely followed. So he got the result. That's the nature of Krishna consciousness. That you start off as a neophyte with so many material ideas or desires. But because the process is purifying, you wind up in a different location than where you started off. Okay. Yes. What do you have? What is this that we're seeing?
The word gentle.
Gentlemen?
Yeah, they always say gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
But they never say gentle ladies. I've never had it before. But you see, right now, I don't know whether there are any historical values. But they are saying the gentle household ladies, the same word.
Where are you looking? What verse?
That's 5.
You're looking at it. Chapter 5? What 5? 5 means what?
No, I'm saying 58 through 59.
58 through 59. Satihi. We should put a footnote. Ladies can also be gentle. Maybe it'll be controversial. Okay? Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Glorious to Srila Prabhupada.
I remember one morning you gave Bhagavatam class here, and just as you were beginning, we heard the kind of motorized...
Oh, yeah.
Garbage men come by. And then you said, what's that sound? And then your whole class was on my airport.
Then Bhagavad Ananda built the cart to replace the tractor.
Yeah.
It was great.
Like you said, it's definitely a challenge.
Yeah, it's a challenge. How to keep my airport wonderful.
Tomorrow,
oh yes, tomorrow, Friday. What happens?
Yeah, well, we need to find a different venue.
Oh, what happens tomorrow?
Because we're giving a test in the Bhakti Shastri, and there's not enough room in the classroom.
So you're going to do it here.
For the people that kind of like sit further and not away from each other.
Okay.
So you've got, you know, like you could use the classroom. The classrooms are empty, or you could use like that area where you were last year. Over much.
Seems to have been kiddified.
Yeah.
Right.
But the ladies will be here. I mean, the test. So you couldn't really have the class there.
It'll disturb what's going on here. Okay, so we have a choice of the classroom or the front. So that's not very good either. So
well, you could be on that side.
Should we take a look? You can come looking for us tomorrow. We'll be someplace, either in the classroom or the
Mm-hmm.